You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Coming up next on the Untold Stories of Broadway podcast, we have a very exciting guest, Rebecca Naomi Jones, current star of Oklahoma. We're going to be talking about the St. James Theater and American Idiot. She's an incredible actress whose other credits are some of my favorite shows, Significant Other, Fortress of Solitude, Passing Stray, and so many shows to talk about. We're excited to have her coming up now. This is Jennifer Ashley Tepper with the Untold Stories of Broadway podcast. And today my guest is the amazing Rebecca Naomi Jones. Hi.
Hello.
I am so happy to talk to you about theaters today.
Me too. I'm really happy we finally made this happen.
Yeah. So I'm super excited to talk about the St. James, where of course you did American Idiot, which was amazing. I saw it 2010, 2011.
Yep.
But first, how are things going at your show? How's Oklahoma?
Things are going well. It's, you know, it's a funny time, like 6 months in to a run on Broadway particularly, where everyone is so intensely tired, but you're still so devoted and you love it so much. But we're just at that place where it's like you have to be really careful, because if you get a little too comfortable, somebody's going to forget a line. You're going to go to the white room, which is what I like to call that. That moment where you're like, what am I doing here? Why am I, what am I speaking about? Why?
That's especially relevant in your production of Oklahoma. It's very white.
It is. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, the lights are on, so it feels extra vulnerable. And it's funny because I ran into Amber Gray the other day on the street, and she said that over at her theater at Hadestown, they're going through the same thing right now, where everybody's sort of feeling a little bit like, are we still all here? Or do we know what we're doing?
Yeah, so, the six-month struggle bus. That's a real thing.
It's a real thing. But, you know, it's still working.
Yeah, the production's incredible. If anyone listening hasn't seen it, go to Circle in the Square right away. Go
see it. It's very special. It's definitely some of the most satisfying work I've ever done.
Cool. One of the things I'm most excited about today is we're going to get to talk a little bit about the original Oklahoma, which is one of the most legendary shows that played the St. James.
Absolutely, yeah.
So before we jump into like St. James history, I'm so curious, what was the first show that you saw at the St. James?
I think the first thing I saw was that production of Forum that happened there. I remember seeing it with my mom. There was a period of time where we were going to see a lot of theater, like anything that we saw on TDF. And I definitely feel like we saw some really funny, famous person in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was such an interesting thing because it was like they captured the old school vaudeville-ness of it. Like it was Nathan Lane and then Whoopi and then David Alan Greer and like personalities.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think we might have seen David Alan Greer. That's absolutely right, which was like a special treat for my mom and I because we used to love Living Color.
Do you know, when I interviewed Jordan Roth, he talked about he discovered a ticket stub for seeing that production when he was really young as well.
Oh my gosh.
And he didn't realize until he found the ticket stub that he had seen the first preview. And so now, like, you know, he runs Drew Jampson and he sits upstairs in his office, but he goes and sits in that seat that he sat in when he was little and saw that Forum.
Oh,
so,
come on.
It's like, that's adorable. Oh,
that's so sweet. And meanwhile, Jordan Roth.
Yes.
Nailing the Lukes these days.
Nailing the Lukes. Nailing the theater and the Lukes.
That's right.
All St. James related. One of the coolest things about the St. James to me is that the offices are right there, the Drew Jampson offices. So it's kind of like, I don't know what your experience was in American Idiot. Did you ever interact with people that were in the Drew Jampson office?
Yeah, occasionally. I mean, it didn't happen very often, but there was a funny little occasional thing that happened with elevators.
Yes.
Sometimes where it was like, wait, what? Oh, yeah.
There's
Hi,
office
guys.
People here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that, you know, because the theater is attached to the offices on Wednesday matinees, there's sometimes like little moments where someone will just like run by in their costume. And it's also, there's that vestibule that's like to the left of the St. James where sometimes performers are, you're like, I remember walking by and seeing a bunch of people in Grinch just like in the vestibule.
Yeah.
The St. James.
I know. I love that theater.
Yeah. So tell me, what was it like moving in American Idiot? Do you remember your first impressions of the theater?
First of all, I will say something that I hold on to so often is how well we were taken care of by our company management and our producers at that theater, because I remember before we even moved in, we were given an allowance for our dressing room decorations. And so everybody got to personalize their dressing rooms and we got to choose paint color and furniture. And that just made it feel so exciting, especially because we were doing a show that was so specific and so you know, full of angst. And it was nice to have your dressing room feel like whatever you wanted it to feel like, be it in line with what the show was for you, in line with your character, or just something else that felt like you. And along with that, the theater felt like it really welcomed us, which is really special because the St. James is so grand and beautiful. I mean, especially now, but it just felt like... you know, they painted the walls of the theater. It was all red and sort of graffitied. And I remember really, really vividly the crew office, which was run by a bunch of family members, this one family and then some other guys. And a couple of them were named Tim, mm-hmm. Timmy. You know, it was like Tim was the dad and then one of the sons was named Timmy. And so, you know, there was a character in American Idiot named St. Jimmy. And so they changed that office to being the St. Timmy office. And they painted it and it was, they opened it up to us. So it wasn't just like the crew's place. It was our place also to hang out sort of right off stage left if, you know, if we had to go on for a scene but had a little bit of a second. And it was very welcoming. It was a really welcoming, generous place to work.
I love hearing about the stagehands and like the stagehand families that are at the theaters. And remember hearing about like Timmy and about all of that. And then I was so excited to learn interviewing people about like Barnum and some shows earlier that he had been there since the 80s. Like,
which is insane.
Since he was a teenager. Yeah.
Because he really... not an old guy.
Right. But it makes them feel like homes, like
yeah,
the theaters.
That's yeah. right. That's right.
So rewinding a lot, the St. James was built in 1927, fun fact. And it was built by this producer named Abraham Erlanger, who was known for being like a pretty ruthless producer businessman. Mm. And pretty soon the theater was, you know, taken over by the Schuberts and then by Jude Jamson later on. But the first show at the theater is interesting because there's actually, I don't know if you remember, there's a giant like poster in the lower lobby near the women's room.
Yes.
It was this show written by George M. Cohan called The Mary Malones that starred George M. Cohan. And every time I go there, there's still this like, it's not a poster. It's like a giant front of house piece that I'm like,
yes.
How is the one front of house piece on display at the St. James the oldest show? Like, that's so
yes.
cool that they have that.
Yes, I remember that. It's almost like a... It looks almost like a crown molding, right? That's like still
yeah.
there. That's like filled with this old, as you said, front of house piece. Yeah. There's something so special about
it's
that
really
when you
cool.
walk by. It's like, wait, what is this?
What is this? So yeah. if you're going to see Frozen, kids, like check out the George M. Cohan thing
yeah.
in the lower lobby.
Yeah.
But one thing that I thought was interesting was George M. Cohan wasn't originally supposed to star in it. And whoever the leading actor was did a bunch of backflips on stage when they were rehearsing, died. And then
nope.
George M. Cohan replaced him. So
nope.
very crazy story. About 1927 Mary Malone's. I know, sad story, but George M. Cohan hadn't starred in a musical for a while, and then the last musical he did on Broadway was also at the St. James. So some George M. Cohan history.
All right.
I'm saluting like that's something he would have done, but you can't see me.
Well, I can, and she saluted.
I saluted. So as far as like backstage, and that's so cool that you guys like take over the dressing rooms, where was your dressing room, and what was the backstage like as far as who was where?
My dressing room was, I guess, the first room, I guess the second floor. So the first floor up from the lower level, from the main level. So I guess that would be considered the second floor. On the bottom floor, we had Russ, who was our usual door person, who my mother adored, but she always called Russell.
Very formal.
And, yeah. And then Michael Esper was right there, and his dressing room was right there. And actually, when I visited Frozen, it was really funny to go backstage and see people in, you know, different places. I was like, oh, this is really bizarre. But anyway, yeah, Esper was there, and I believe Stark Sands was also on that floor. And then up sort of on the stage level, a little bit up from the stage level, there's another dressing room, and that's mm-hmm. where Tony Vincent was. And down in the basement was where Johnny Gallagher was. So on the second floor, I had mine, and then... right down the hall from me was where the rest of the ladies were. So it was Alicia, Libby, Leslie, Lauren Lotero, and I believe Aspen Vincent was in there as well. And then up on the floor above us was Mary Faber and Christina Saju.
I cannot believe how well you remember this. It's amazing.
Well, it was a really impactful time.
Yeah,
it was
as
really...
you're naming all these people, I'm like, you guys are still really close.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a close group. But were you friends with those people before? Was it like a show bonding moment?
It was a show bonding moment, really and truly. I don't think I knew anyone beforehand. I think Mary Faber and I had done a reading. Gosh, oh my gosh. I think we had done a reading with Tom Kitt randomly years before, but we really didn't know each other. And And same with Tom Kidd. I mean, we hadn't known each other except for that reading. So that show really, really bonded us, though. I think because it was such hard work, it felt physically so demanding that I think that forces you to feel like a team. And and also because of Stephen Hoggett's choreography and the way he ran a rehearsal room and how important he found it to be that we got together before the show to warm up, which he does apparently with all of his shows. That I think that really bonds a cast.
Yeah. So I feel like the two things I hear about that are the most bonding are if there's like a green room or a St. Timmy's like gathering spot and the pre-show. Like if you get to connect with people when you're not on stage, that makes a big difference.
It's so important because especially, I mean, as we were saying, like several months into a show, it just gets harder and harder no matter how much you love it, no matter how much you respect it, no matter how much you're someone who refuses to phone it in, it's hard. It's really hard work to do day after day after day. And so if you can hold on to the fact that you're not alone and that you're with other people who are, you know, managing the fatigue along with you, it really helps.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I love knowing where everyone was in American Idiot because one of my favorite things to kind of learn about the theaters is however much I can find out about whose dressing room was whose. And sometimes people, you know, sign underneath. But when you're digging back, the St. James is actually the one that I was able to find out like a lot about who it was where during some of the legendary shows. So, and you know, I feel like there's the stage right, like more isolated star-ish dressing room. And then there's the stage left, stage level one.
Yes.
So it was like, you know, Nathan Lane had stage right, Matthew Broderick had stage left on the producers. And then I was even able to find out that Gertrude Lawrence had stage right and Yul Brynner had stage left on The King and I.
Wow.
So it's like getting to like dig back. And then it just makes you, I think, really realize like there are so many people that have played the St. James. Like because it's such a legendary, like appreciated musical house that one of the other things I heard about it over and over was how great the sound is. And American Idiot, of course, I feel like sound was so important because one thing that was so awesome about the show was it sounded like Green Day, like a rock concert, but it was so important to hear the lyrics and you could. And that's something going back that, you know, producers always want the St. James because the lyrics like are clear.
Yes.
Of course, you were in the show, so you probably didn't see it to know, but the sound is awesome.
It's so important. And I remember hearing that it was, that the sound was really good. And it is such a tricky thing, especially with a rock musical, to find the right balance so people can still get the story and hear the lyrics and still feel the music.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
One of the other cool pieces of St. James history that I love is there's this musical called Fine and Dandy, which had music by Kay Swift, and it was actually the first hit Broadway musical composed by a woman. She was like incredible, and if you're listening to this, kids, go look her up, Kay Swift. She was, you know, frequent collaborators and best friends with George Gershwin, which often is how people know about her. She's kind of a footnote. She did a lot of the, you know, vocal and music arranging on Porgy and Bess, and, you know, she was amazing.
Oh,
but Fine and Dandy was like a huge hit in 1930, and, you know, she became the first female composer of a Broadway hit musical. So,
wow.
Yay, St. James.
I'm embarrassed I didn't know that about her.
It's not
Porgy and Bess.
Yeah, she was like his closest musical confidant in that way. So she did a lot of work on his work, which is why we probably don't have more original musicals from her. But the St. James did have her big hit show, which is cool.
So cool.
I'm going to, oh gosh, where is it?
Uh-oh.
No, I found it. It's fine. I'm going to make you read a story that I'm really excited to have you read.
Great.
And it is a story from my book that was told to me by George S. Irving, and that's all I'm going to tell you.
All right. Great. the title will give something away. 1943, Everything's Going My Way. George S. Irving, actor. I never saw a Broadway show until I was in one. You needed a few bucks to get into a theater, and I didn't have any money. The first Broadway show I was in was the original production of Oklahoma in 1943. During the summer of 1942, I had a job at the St. Louis Muni Opera, singing in the chorus and doing small parts in the shows. For the last show of the season, at the end of August, we did Showboat, and Norma Terrace, Broadway's original Magnolia, starred. Oscar Hammerstein came out to St. Louis to see the production. One day, he was standing at the front of the audience section of the huge amphitheater, watching, when the young man singing the role of Joe, the old man River part, became sick with laryngitis. He was out of the show, and another actor, John Tyers, replaced him. I replaced John Tyers. Oscar took that in during rehearsal, and I got to know him a little bit that day as he yelled back and forth from the house to the stage. Later that winter, I heard that the Theater Guild was going to do a musical based on Green Grow the Lilacs, a play by Lynn Riggs. So I wrote Oscar a letter reminding him who I was and telling him that I would love a chance to audition for a job in the chorus. He got me an appointment, and I came in and got the job. I'm originally from Springfield, Massachusetts. Oklahoma played out of town in both New Haven at the Schubert and in Boston at the Colonial. It was an expensive move, but there was money in those days to do that kind of thing. I was a kid in the chorus, so I didn't know much about the troubles the show was having. I did know that there was a Mary Martin vehicle in Boston at the same time. It was called Dancing in the Streets, and it was highly touted. People didn't have a lot of hope for our show because there were no bare-legged girls. But that show ended up being a big flop, and ours was a big hit. When I moved into the St. James, I was amazed. I had never seen a Broadway theater before. Since I was always fond of ballet, I would watch Agnes DeMille's dance rehearsals avidly. I was in the background of some of the dances, but I really paid attention to what the dancers were doing. My roommate, John Baum, was in the show, too. And we were pals with Diana Adams and Bambi Lynn, our castmates. We'd all go to lunch together. We made history with Oklahoma. Then a week after Oklahoma opened on Broadway, I received my draft notice. They gave me 3 weeks to report for duty. I had to give my notice at the show, and they hired another kid to replace me. Then, at the end of the 3 weeks, the draft board said, "We're full up, and we don't need you." There I was, without a job. I heard that up the street, they were looking for a chorus boy at Lady in the Dark. I auditioned for Morris Abravanel, the music director, and Moss Hart, who was directing and had written the book. And I got the job. As I started rehearsing, they built beautiful new costumes for me. It was a wonderful show, and Gertie Lawrence was tremendous in it. Then, on my first night in the show, I got a letter from the draft board saying they needed me to report. I responded, "Please, I cannot do that to these people who just hired me. Give me a few weeks." They relented and let me stay in the show for a month. A suitable replacement was found, and then I was really and truly in the army.
Crazy. I know. It just blows my mind to be like, oh, someone is talking about World War II and Oklahoma. And yeah. It's amazing. He had an amazing career.
Yeah. It's also amazing that he's just like, well, I'll just go up the street and audition for this one. And then I got that job too. Yeah. And then I had to go back to the army. Yeah. It's just what a funny, weird story.
I know. And so like, you know, thinking about the Muni having existed back then, of course, because it's, you know, legendary and that old. And so is the St. James. And these things that we think of as being like ours have been around. You know?
Yeah. That's right. That's a good reminder. It's a good reminder that everything we're doing at all time is really not ours.
Yeah. It's, you know, the legacy and like the continuity of those things.
That's right.
So one cool thing, you know, obviously the St. James has a long history of like Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals. So Oklahoma, but also King and I and Flower Drum Song. And just, you know, the musical comedies that have been there too. Like it's such a great house. It's a large house, but it feels like intimate.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did see Frozen there and I was so surprised. Even a Disney show, which is massive and sparkly, still felt intimate.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Do you have any memories, like favorite memories from the American Idiot run as far as like what, I mean, that performance, like how did you sustain that for as long? Like it was such an incredible and, you know, huge performance.
Yeah. I mean, I have so many incredible memories from that time. But I was just speaking to Damon Dono and Jimmy Davis at the theater the other day about, Damon was like, was American Idiot this hard? And I said, yeah, I mean, it was almost as hard. I was younger. And also that show was 90 minutes long with no intermission. And
right,
Oklahoma is 3 hours long with an intermission. Plus the lights are on and we feel the audience and every little move and every little phone that goes off and every whisper.
Gosh.
That's a nightmare. But that's a whole other story.
I bet.
But they were asking about it. And I said, well, you know, what was so incredible about that show and how it could sort of, you know, catapult you out of the feeling of I can't do this tonight, mm-hmm. is that guitar would start at the beginning and it just would propel you onto the stage. Literally, if you were the women, I mean, we like sort of exploded onto the stage in the first act, in the first song, and it just felt like it never stopped after mm-hmm. that for the 90 minutes. So you sort of were up on the journey once you were there and riding the wave, mm-hmm. Which was so incredible. But yeah, I mean, it was, I have so many incredible memories. I mean, I had a brief moment backstage during, I guess it must have been Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and the break between that song and whatever came after it. It might have been St. Jimmy, actually. And I remember watching my castmates, the people who were in the ensemble, running, like racing backstage to do quick changes, because that's so much of that show is like people are on stage and then people are running off stage, throwing clothes off. I mean, there were so many little, we had these what are those things called? Like costume racks.
Yeah.
But basically like the whole backstage, which is the we had a large backstage area, and there were like basically makeshift costume racks for every member of the ensemble.
Wow.
And so everybody had these hooks, and they were like, you know, the hooks were sort of like in order of the costume changes, and because there were so many right backstage quick changes. And so the ensemble, I mean, it's going to sound a little bit crass of me to say, but you could just watch people just like strip down naked and then just like throw on entirely new outfits in no time. But it was incredible. It's just because people are still singing. They're still singing their harmonies, racing together, and then, you know, disrobing and then racing back on and singing something else and sort of walking on at a different speed. And I mean, it was just one of those things that I just was so constantly impressed and amazed by the people I was working with. And, you know, similarly to the situation I'm in now, just very much in love with everyone that I get to do this with every day. And I still feel that way about all of those people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I loved and that always struck me about American Idiot was I feel like in the musical theater, like I can never say this word, oeuvre. How do you say it?
Oeuvre, I think, yeah.
I say that badly, but you get what I'm saying.
You have a lot of skills.
Thank you.
Okay.
In musical theater in general, there are so many angry young man songs and we don't get a lot of angry young woman songs.
Correct.
And listen to the American Idiot cast recording because there's just these hugely gratifying moments of like angry young woman.
Yeah.
And it's so fantastic.
It's so true. They even kept a little line that I added in, which is in the middle of Letterbomb. One day I just screamed at John, "Wake up!" And that became part of the script.
Oh my God, I love that. Have you ever seen like a middle school, high school camp production? You know, have you seen?
I have not seen a middle school or high school production, but I've seen a college production
okay.
that Leslie McDonald directed at Pace downtown.
Okay.
And it was incredible.
Yeah.
It was a really, really great production. It must have been only a couple of years after we closed. It was a couple of years ago now, but it was really great. And it was great to see her version of it, and it was great to sort of see how I could make sense of it watching it, because it is all sung through except for those tiny little brief monologues that the Johnny character says, and you know, so it can be a little bit you know, like a painting. It's like you have to sort of figure out what it means for yourself. So but I loved it so much.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
To get to see someone like scream wake up. And
yeah.
That was you.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. But I also have all the time at the stage door, I have women say, I just played What's Her Name in my high school's production or my college production.
Cool.
This afternoon I had somebody say, I was just in Passing Strange.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, it's very
I love
it's
that.
Sweet.
So
it's
cool.
Very sweet when that happens.
Thank you so much for tuning in to part one of the Untold Stories of Broadway podcast with this week's guest, Rebecca Naomi Jones. Stay tuned for part two of Rebecca Naomi Jones' exciting interview. Thank you to our producer, Dori Berenstein, our editor, Alan Seals, my publishers of the Untold Stories of Broadway, Brisa Trinquero and Roberta Pereira, Zach Zadek for that theme music. And thank you to all of you for listening to the podcast. You can buy the Untold Stories in book version on Amazon.com.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.